We pick up with part two of a speech in Vancouver, British Columbia by Dr. Ricky Ott on the truth and the myth of the Exxon Valdez spill and what we can learn from it now.
On April 26, 2006, Dr. Ricky Ott of Cordova, Alaska, an expert on the impacts of the Exxon Valdez tanker disaster, spoke to an audience at the Vancouver Public Library. Dr. Ott's speech was sponsored by a coalition of environmental groups opposing offshore oil and gas development and tanker traffic through the pristine coastal waters of British Columbia. Drawing from her book, Sound, Truth, and Corporate Myths, The Legacy of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill, Dr. Ott addressed the ecological, social, and economic aftermath of the Exxon catastrophe, the consequences of which are still being felt 17 years after the accident. Dr. Ott's knowledge and experience provides valuable insights for citizens around the world concerned about the impacts of oil transport and offshore drilling on marine and human communities. The Living Ocean Society,
the Georgia Strait Alliance,
the David Suzuki Foundation, and the other members of the BC Coalition hope the lessons learned in Alaska can help to prevent similar disasters in our oceans. Dr. Ott.
Exxon essentially lists everything as recovered, okay? This is the other side of the story. Now, what the scientists determined was that after these ecosystem studies, it looked like the birds, the fish, and the mammals that were all having lingering problems seemed to be species that shared the intertidal habitat. So what was up with the intertidal, what was up with the beaches of Prince William Sound? And the native people who live out on the sound had been saying for years, there's oil on the beaches, there's oil on the beaches. So finally the scientists go out and they dig lower. They dig in the low intertidal. The cleanup had focused in the high intertidal because that's the area that's most exposed between tides. I mean, you have the longest time to work on it. And because it's mostly bare rock. It's not the slippery kelps and seaweeds and stuff. So this, the lower intertidal was pretty much left in 89. Scientists went and dug, and they found, lo and behold, lots of oil, to their horror. And it looks like this. This is a 2003 photo. You dig just a little, 6 inches is enough. And the seawater that wells in comes pushing up a sheen of oil, which is PAHs. And you can see here in this photo, this is the photo on the back of Sound Truth, there's mussels, there's limpets, there's barnacles, there's intertidal invertebrates, shellfish, that are soaking up this oil, because it's right there. The scientists then asked the question, well, are these guys soaking it up? Are these prey items soaking it up? And if so, how bad? And what you see is this graph showing that on the left is total polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. So each of these yellow bars shows how much PAHs were in the tissue of each of these animals, clams, worms, a little gunnel, a little fish, and mussels and other beach life. It's there. So to the scientists, this was shocking because, they really found that oil did persist after all these years. Oil was still persistent, still out there. It was still working its way into the food web. It's still Exxon's oil. They had to chemically fingerprint it. Exxon denied that it was its oil. Our federal scientists sort of proved it. And the scientists have now concluded that persistent, bioavailable, and toxic. The scientists pretty much concluded that the elevated biomarkers, the enzymes, that they found in sea otters, sea ducks, fish in the oiled areas were linked to the poor population recovery in these areas. So now we have this mirror, sick people, sick wildlife. Okay, I'm going to move now into social ramifications, but only just very briefly to explain that it's more than about physical illnesses. This is another shift in scientific understanding that happened because of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. There's a whole realm of science called social science, which measures effects on people, families, communities. And the thinking in the up through the 1970s and beginning of the 80s was that the social scientists studied flood, fires, earthquakes, natural disasters. So the whole theory of social science was framed on people's emotional response to natural disasters, floods, fires, earthquakes. What the scientists found in studying these natural disasters was that they're very short-term social effects. Yes, people are displaced from their homes if there's a fire or a flood or an earthquake, but then people come back, the federal government roars in to help, you're helping your neighbor put out fires, you're building sandbags to dam the river. I mean, you're working together against nature, right? So it actually builds social bonds. Social bonds are like a level of trust. It's a level of trust that is a foundation for relationships. So when you're working together, you're actually building these social bonds. And it actually became, some of these communities come out stronger in the end. They come out what the social scientists call a therapeutic community for this experience. And the emotional trauma mitigation models were kind of wrapped around a natural disaster, how you help people recover from this shock. Well, what the scientists were finding was that, gosh, this mitigation model was not working for things like Love Canal in New York, which was a toxic chemicals, Bhopal in India, which was the Dow chemical gas escape, which killed people, the Chernobyl, which the 20th anniversary is today, by the way, which was the nuclear meltdown. And so the social scientists were just starting to say, what have we got here with these technological disasters? We seem to have a new species of trouble. How do we mitigate emotional harm? First of all, what are they? Well, the social scientists were just starting to find that they cause long-term social effects, and that these things destroyed social bonds because there was somebody to blame. There was a spiller. There was the government. It was not an act of God, all right? So there was somebody to blame, and that becomes very divisive. Lawsuits and all kinds of things. And you end up with, it's a threat that you don't know. When is it going to be all clear? When are these chemicals going to be? I'll get into this in a minute. But there's a fear of the unknown that makes for a corrosive community. That's what it's called. And the natural disaster mitigation models do not work. They flat don't work. So what Cordova has the distinction of becoming the longest running case study, of this type of man-made disaster and emotional trauma and mitigation of that trauma. And I don't know if that's something to brag about or what, but there you are. And what we found is that there's something called a peer listening circle, which is very similar to the native talking circles, to drag the survivors out of their fear and concern and get them working on something greater than themselves. That's how you get the survivors, snap them out of this, and start rebuilding. Okay, this is our community now. This is our reality now. Where do we go from here? So let me give some examples from Cordova. What the sociologists found, yes, I really did fish, was that there were two subgroups most at risk. These are the subgroups that were most connected to the environment. Surprise, surprise. Commercial fishing, because of the economic, and the Native Americans, because of their culture, their subsistence culture. So those two subgroups have been studied compared to the controls. And this is Cordova. What the sociologists found was that communities dependent on the environment suffer more than communities that are dependent on other things. Right? So all your coastal communities in BC, for example, would be right up there with having this kind of trauma. Our people's culture, so if you're a Native American or First Nations person, lifestyle choices, if you choose to live close to the environment, and in our case, jobs with commercial fishing. It affects individuals, families, and friends. Again, think about this. If you're afraid, if you don't know, how am I going to pay my debt, who are you going to snap at? You're going to snap at your spouse, right? Or your friends, or your family, the people closest to you. So this ends up being a big flipping mess. It really, really does. And there are secondary effects associated with the cleanup, when all the money spilled into our community, secondary effects associated with the litigation, which is being dragged on and on and on and on. And so that the sociologists have actually measured these effects flip now from the oil spill itself to the litigation. And the stress is still high. And it's lingering harm. Our stress level in Cordova, those two subgroups, is as high as 17 years ago. And unfortunately, this is invisible. This harm right now is invisible in terms of the legal system, the response system. So when Exxon stood in front of our community 5 days after the spill and said, "Don't worry, you have Exxon, we will make you whole," they didn't add footnote to the extent that the law allows. Because there's no way they're going to compensate us for this because they don't have to. We asked for emotional trauma counseling people in 1989. We didn't get them. One of the native people in one of the communities observed that, geez, what Exxon is paying to rehabilitate a sea otter, would one sea otter, $80,000, would have covered the entire year's salary for a counselor in just one community. So let me just show how this manifests in Cordova. We have an unknown future. How long will it take our fisheries to recover? We have financial problems. If I'm not fishing my herring permit, how am I going to pay my debts on that permit, on my boat, on my home, which I've now mortgaged twice? And the litigation is, when will I have closure on this? I mean, it's like a scab that you can't close this part of your life until this is over. And the litigation in our case, in 1994, there was an award, a jury award of $5.3 billion, of which the 0.3 is compensatory to pay for what the jury thought was the actual harm to our fisheries. However, the $5 billion has been appealed. And we are looking still to this day. And we are looking at that $5 billion punitive as compensatory for long-term harm, which was never acknowledged in 1994. There is a film that was put out by Macumba International, Endless Fallout, and it's just now being released today. It's a Quebec, Canada company. It's being released today over in the Ukraine because it weaves together Bhopal, Chernobyl, and Exxon Valdez as the three largest technological disasters the world has yet seen and what the world is in for, because these are all 20 years now on these disasters. And everybody's still having lingering effects. So if we're going to live in a technology, society, what are we going to do about these communities that experience the fallout? I'm going to attempt to summarize this, all right? So one is promises betrayed. What we have learned in Alaska is that the oil industry promises a lot, but unless those things are written into law, you will not get what you're promised. For example, the oil companies promised double-hull tankers before the Trans-Alaska pipeline was authorized in 1971, 1973. They started promises in 71. Forget it. We never got double-hull tankers, and now we have the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, right? Double-hull tankers. And still, that's only talking about minimizing the risk. It's not talking about eliminating it. So the promises. There is an increased risk now with oil use. The increased risk is because we know that oil is more hazardous to people than we thought, it's more harmful to the environment than we thought, and it's more harmful to our communities than we thought. This risk, increased risk, needs to be factored into the risk-benefit equation that when you're making decisions about whether you want the oil company in your backyard or not, the benefits are always put forward first, right? Nobody ever mentions about, oh, by the way, there's an increased risk. There really is no way to clean up oil once it gets on beaches. So what I was talking about earlier with that high-pressurized hot water wash, the scientists actually found that the beaches that were treated like that took longer to recover than beaches that were not treated. Now, that does not mean that beaches should not be that nothing should be done if there's an oil spill. What this means is that you need to keep spilled oil from getting on your beach. So if it's in an open ocean, you want to try to disperse it, burn it, gel it, whatever. You want to boom. You want to be prepared to boom sensitive habitat so you can deflect the oil off beaches. You want to be ready to do something. You don't just sit back and do nothing. And the oil industry should be encouraged to come up with more realistic ways to clean up oil than these dispersants that effectively add more toxic chemicals into the mix. I mean, that's all some of these chemicals do. And fourth is choose wisely. In Alaska, we first fought the battle in the 1970s about whether we wanted the oil industry in our backyard or not. That was fought by the generation of fishermen before me. And when they lost, it was a Supreme Court decision, we won. Then it was overturned by an act of Congress by Vice President Spiro Agnew. It was actually a tie vote. That's how close that all was. We wanted the oil routed through Canada. Because we didn't want a terminus in our backyard because we were worried about a big spill. So we lost that battle. And the thing is, when you have the oil industry in your backyard, that's a given. You're going to have a spill. It's just a given. The night before the spill, I was saying it's not a matter of if, it's when. 4 hours before the oil spill happened, that's what I was saying. So choose wisely. I mean, the coastline in British Columbia looks and feels like what we had in Prince William Sound before March 24th, 1989. So I think what I would like to finish is with one more slide, if you'll tolerate it. I think we need a new way of problem solving and decision making. And what I'd like to propose is maybe to think about this. We learned in our Cordova community, we actually brought in, we were the first on-the-ground sustainable community project in Alaska. What is a sustainable community? How can you make it work? How can we codify our values into law? And so we started looking at what we had. Well, we had environmental capital or wealth. We had it in the form of our forests, our fish resources, and our scenic beauty. I mean, tourists wanted to come and see that, right? It's very similar to here. We had oil, too. We have oil off our coastline in the Copper River. So that's our environmental wealth. We have economic wealth. Economic wealth are jobs, right? You need jobs. You need to keep that going. We had social wealth. Social wealth is an indicator of how people care about your community. So it's like how many people vote out of how many people live there. It's a measure of how many people volunteer, how active is a volunteer force. And the idea we decided was that we wanted to encourage businesses that increased one form of capital but didn't decrease the other two. All right, but we also wanted to bring in businesses that sort of matched our values, which meant we had to sit down and think about this in big meetings like this. And we'd pass around 3x5 cards and say, okay, why do you like living here? You've got 3 minutes to write out your answer. And these would take all day, all right? And then we'd sit around the big circle and we'd say, what's on your card? And everybody would read to everybody else, and people were just shocked that the values were very, very similar. And I guarantee you that's why people like to live here. And when I've done this type of workshop, I've led these workshops in other communities, whether it's rural or urban, the basic values, the core values are very similar. People want to have a home, they want to have a job, you want to be where it's safe. You feel like you have a safe community, your children can play, you're not going to get mugged, you know, in the parking lot, coming home from work. You have your health. You don't have to pay for your health. It's a given that you can live a healthy life. Education for yourself, education for your children. Pretty much people everywhere want clean water and clean air. There's a connection with clean water, clean air, and health. And in Alaska, but I suspect here too, with your First Nation people in particular, subsistence plays a big, you know, role, whether it's lifestyle or culture. You want access to wild fish and wild food. And finally, beauty. Most people like to live where it's pretty. So what we started saying was, okay, look, let's talk about different things. So we actually did this exercise with cruise ships. We did this exercise with clear-cut logging. We did not do it with oil, but let's just try doing it with oil. What would happen? Well, clean air, clean water would go. That's what's happening on the north slope of Alaska, where the native folks are living downstream of the flares, the oil flares. They're getting asthma. So then your health goes. I forgot what I just had there. Oh, yeah. If you don't have clean air and clean water, you're going to have fewer resources, which is what's happened in Prince William Sound. The subsistence ability to subsist has gone down. And finally, it's not so safe. It's not so safe anymore. So what values do you want to trade in order to bring the industries in? In Alaska, in Cordova, what we did with like cruise ships was we limited the size of them by ordinance. Because we said we can handle small, but we just don't want huge. It changes, it interferes with our quality of life. We said, you know, we don't want clear-cut logging, but we would encourage sustainable forestry. So we actually made choices. And I think that this is now what's facing us with here in BC. It certainly looks like what's facing you with the oil industry. It's looking like 1970s in Alaska. Is this something we want or not? And I will tell you that once you get on a train and that train is headed towards a destination, every station is going to be en route to that destination. So choose your destination wisely. And I guess these websites here, there are three of them. One is soundtruth.info. That's my website. There is the Prince William Sound Regional Citizen Advisory Council, pwsrcac.org. And that they have a lot. That's one of the citizen oversight groups. There's a lot of information that they do on the oil industry to oversee it. Citizen watchdog group. And finally, the copperriver.org is about the sustainable community project that I was talking about.
You can order Dr. Ricky Ott's book, Sound Truth and Corporate Myths, from any online bookseller, including Amazon.com. You can go to our website at soundtruth.info. And for more information on this issue, go to oilfreecoast.org or livingoceans.org. This lecture was recorded by Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org. And you can find a full copy of the lecture for listening or download at that site.